Welcome, everyone, to the Pop Culture Podcast by Fantastic Geek. My name is Matt. Joining me, as always, is Pete. Hello, Pete.
Hello, Matt. Hello, everyone. Here today to discuss the 2016 presidential election. Oops, no, I mean the Warner Brothers DC Suicide Squad.
Just in case the Secret Service is listening, that's Peter, P-I-E-T-E-R-J, Kittle. Anyhow, Pete, but I digress. So we had the, I guess let's give some backstory here. We had chosen a show to meet up at for Suicide Squad, the theater of choice, the theater that we usually meet up at to see a movie. AMC has done all this stuff with pre-buying tickets and their club to get you to pre-buy and all that. And I said, Pete, 11 a.m. show. It's not an assigned seating show. Let's just show up, grab some tickets, have a nice time. It's a little bit cheaper. That show was sold out. Okay, let's go to the 12 o'clock show. You know, we can grab a bite to eat ahead of time. That show was all but sold out. And we ended up going to another theater about 15 minutes away, which didn't have all these promotions, to a theater which was
Essentially empty when we arrived for an 11:30 show, not willing to sit in the very first row for that noon show at the theater, equidistant between our two homes. So there we are. And Matt, I think it was pretty telling that as we were going in, there was an elderly gentleman with a walker who asked somebody to open the door for him for the one side of the theater. And I'm like, okay. You know, and anybody can go see a movie. Does this man know what this movie is? And then over on the side of the theater where we went in, there later was another elderly gentleman, this time no walker. And all right, maybe senior citizen discount. It's 11:30. I'm going to go to the movies, but it was odd. And they were two of the not so many patrons in this theater for a movie that has had its cumulative over the weekend twice adjusted down.
All of that being said, to be completely fair, still a huge opening at, last I saw was like $135 million. So big opening. I mean, we can talk, I guess now, about the fact that it cost $175 million, and that's before marketing and promotion and all that. So a very, very solid, respectable opening. Eyes certainly look to what it'll do week two. If Batman v Superman is any indication, when you get into critical reviews, how that reflects the audience, Rotten Tomatoes, etc., could be a rough go. But Pete, enough about the other people, okay? I don't need numbers to build my understanding of things. Pete, what did you think of the movie?
Well, I'm going to spin it to you like this. I don't think we can talk about this entry in the DC murderverse on its own. It's part of, you know, two other movies at this point. So I've got to say that this lands squarely between Man of Steel as the best of the three, and Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice as, garbage on your shoe.
Wow. Let's remember, dear audience, I, of course, was pleasantly surprised with Batman v Superman. I think that the taste has decreased, the memory of it has decreased, but I had overall good things to say about that movie, although, you know, recognizing its flaw, kind of a C-plus type movie. This, I would say, let me put it this way. If there's going to be a heartbreaker in today's podcast, Pete, it's going to be me. I am not a fidgety person by nature. I'm not somebody with the ants in the pants or whatever. And where we were sitting in this slightly older theater, it was like, I don't know why it was, but there was like the slightest of inclines in the row that we were on. So there was like a little bit of ledge where my feet were, where you was not. I don't know why there was a slight incline up, whatever. At a certain point, with about 15 minutes to go, 20 minutes to go, I realized that I was doing the foot back and forth on the corner of the ledge, and I was like, I want to stop this. I need to stop this. I don't want to be, you know, an annoyance, if only to my pal Pete. But I was ready for it to leave, and I was grateful that the movie ended the way it is, which is, well, we'll get to that all in due course. But so I guess it's not spoilers ahead, because of course there's going to be spoilers ahead. But I guess if you're Team Matt and Team Suicide Squad, we're going to have some words here.
I thought I was fidgeting too much because I had to go to the bathroom so bad by the end of this movie. I was hoping that it would end much more quickly.
Anyhow, Pete, let's do a roll call here. Talk about our thoughts of each character. I know on some particular areas we'll get into the good, the bad, and the ugly later on. But let's start at the top. A box office draw, I think, despite his recent failures at the box office, somebody who I think in many ways may have helped make the audience that we saw it old and young, somebody who in many ways I think defies label, Will Smith as Deadshot.
And here it winds up being his biggest opening ever. I appreciate that he's now at the point in his career where he says, okay, I can join this ensemble cast. And when you consider the collection of talent that we're going to talk about, that they've opened to a big number, but not to critical praise, I think is very much worth pointing out. But, you know, here he is, the mercenary with a heart of gold. He gets to have the biggest story. He's clearly the biggest box office draw. And maybe that's why there were two elderly gentlemen that we could see here turning out for this movie. Oh, I'll go see the Will Smith movie.
Yeah, I mean, he was his normal self, and that's in no way a slam. For years and years now, I've kind of equated Will Smith to Charlton Heston when he was an active movie star, obviously prior to his death and all that. But when he was kind of at his popular phase, 50s, 60s, 70s, it's like everybody likes Charlton Heston. Charlton Heston did some weird movies. He did some Westerns. He did some Bible. He did some sci-fi zombie future. You get the same Charlton Heston. Same thing with Will Smith. You get, come to think of it, the Western. You get the zombie future, you know. Will Smith is Will Smith. Everybody likes Will Smith. Yeah, here he's playing a bad guy. He's got a little bit of a heart of gold. He's fine. I don't mean to diminish it. He is a superstar as Will Smith playing Deadshot, and it's fine.
But Matt, they all, with the exception of the character we'll talk about next, have a heart of gold. And that, I think, is the problem in the DC murderverse, is that everybody should be a villain and no one should be any of these heroes, Matt. All of our heroes thus far in this cinematic universe are tortured, strained individuals, and all of its villains, with the exception of the Joker, have this inherently good value. You know, Deadshot's got the daughter that he wants to help with murder math later in the movie, which, you know, play that for maybe some more laughs to have it fall a little bit more tone deaf. Yeah, you have Flag stopping them with the chains because they are now brothers in arms. But at the same time, he's talking about the hypotenuse of killing people. All right. And as we go through the roster here, we'll continue, and I'll continue to point that out, is that you want to be these bad people because you can act badly. There's other than the Joker, what we have of him, there's no one inherently evil, and it doesn't quite add up in this cinematic universe.
I know that writer and director David Ayer said in defense of, you know, kind of what you're saying, he wasn't saying it directly to us, of course, but kind of in defense of that complaint, he said, I wanted to reflect, and this isn't a direct quote, but he said, I wanted to reflect the fact that in our world, in the real world, there is that gray line, there is that grayness between good and evil, to which I would respond, yeah, but we don't go to the movies most of the time to see the real world. And particularly with these characters, you know, I mean, if Superman is at the top of the list for the Boy Scout that always does the right thing, well, you know what? Give me a gajillion dollars and some family troubles. Maybe I'm Bruce Wayne too, who at the end of the day is doing the right thing and trying to keep it quiet, keep it private, keep it all that. There's a certain kind of moving away from that gray line that I think is what comic book movies are about, and I think that what most movies are about. But oh well, I'm not the one that wrote the movie in 6 weeks, which, by the way, is a number I've trotted out a lot on Twitter. At the end of the day, I don't blame David Ayer for writing a less than perfect script in 6 weeks.
No, I think a lot of movies are written in 6 weeks. Rocky was reputedly written in a weekend, Matt. It can succeed. It's the schedule and everything that comes with that. And, oh, we can't move a tentpole date and we're going to assemble rival cuts of the movie. It comes out in a post-Deadpool world where now we can have this sardonic hard R thing, yet this is not that. It's a hodgepodge, and you know, it really comes across that way. I just want to say one other thing about, you know, the criminals, the rogues gallery assembled, which I think was a poor choice. None of them ever tries to take one another out, and I think if you had this assembly of evil, they'd see one another as threats. They wouldn't get along. They wouldn't play nice. Instead of the nice that goes on with Deadshot and Harley Quinn and Captain Australia and the others.
Excuse me, it's Captain Boomerang, but he's farther down the list.
It's Captain Australia.
Next on the list, of course, is the Joker, played by Jared Leto. For some of us, ever. Of my so-called life fame. Pete, what was your take on this familiar character?
I appreciated this Joker more than I thought I would, with everybody last year seeing the tattoos and the grill and all of that. He's in it so little. I've seen a number at like 7 minutes. We don't get to know him. There's a more interesting movie that is he and Harley Quinn and their strange and sad adventures than this overall film. That's a movie I'd watch. I'd pay to watch. We made no bones when we were going to see this movie that we were going to a matinee, and we would not pay a matinee price to sit and strain our necks and look up in the first row. And again, for people who want to hear our take as aficionados of this material, but he is not, and nor could he ever expect to be, with the role as written, to be Heath Ledger, to be Jack Nicholson, to be even Mark Hamill, and he's got to come after all of those guys.
I would say he somehow finds something new in this oldest of characters.
Agreed.
that is separate from all of those other people. I read a quote online. Is he the best Joker? Well, except for Heath Ledger. Well, and then there's Jack Nicholson. And then there's Mark Hamill. And then there's Cesar Romero. I think he fits equal to all of them with what he brings. I think he's the most frightening Joker that has been on screen.
Again, comparatively speaking, I think it's apples and bowling balls, because we can't line them up. It's an interesting presentation. He's an Academy Award winning actor. So much was made when he took on the role, but it's so scant in the film. You know, he has big repercussions and he gets the big flourish. You know, we knew he wasn't dead. And, you know, of course he comes back and gets her. You know, I'm a little bit more concerned about where his character affects Harley Quinn.
Well, let's talk about Harley Quinn then. A character who like, I don't remember her first time on Batman the Animated Series, but certainly I was watching the Batman cartoon when she debuted. So I remember a time before Harley Quinn, but it still is a time from my childhood. And Pete, considering I'm the guy that's supposed to not like this movie, let me just say Margot Robbie's Harley Quinn is the pinnacle of perfection when it comes to translating this character from its origins onto the silver screen.
It's hard seeing what they translated onto the screen, thinking as somebody else other than Margot Robbie at this point. But again, I think the choices that are made and come across, okay, we're gonna quickly shotgun her origin. She was a doctor. She fell in love with the Joker and then brought him a machine gun, and then he electrocuted her, and then they were at his Acme chemical lair and made her jump into the chemicals, and then was going to walk away, and then jumped in, and they're in love. Can we see the falling in love instead of, I brought you a kitty, and now I'll bring you a machine gun? So much has been written and been said the past couple of days about the over-sexualization of the character. She is a sexy character. The amount of cosplay, Matt, we have seen over the years that clearly show how into this character people are, and women in particular, although we've seen our fair share of male Harley Quinns, goes to show that. But I feel like they made her a pastiche, and then that they create this, okay, you know, she wants to be normal. Yeah, you know, she's out of her mind, but she wants to be normal. But he made her crazy because she's in love. You know, there's that whole Mad Love comic. They would have been better served doing that here, because all right, here's Harley Quinn and the Joker for dummies.
There certainly is an argument to be made that the character, animated series, comic, and even in the movie, that there's a road, it starts to go to a place that you don't want to go down, in terms of she is defined by him and she is defined by their abuse and that sort of thing. I think here, though, the movie somehow, the movie, with writing flaws aplenty, found a way with Harley Quinn to have its cake and eat it too. I think that her crazy and his crazy, it comes off as mutual. And yes, there are things like, you know, she has to prove herself through self-damage by jumping into the Acme chemical vat. Later on in the movie, he drives the car into the river knowing she can't swim. So there are moments where I think you have to take pause if you really want to hold up their relationship by real world modern day standards and all that. But I think that those are the exceptions to the rule, and that you by and large get the feeling that this is a safe and consensual thing going on from two insane people.
I find it incredibly one-sided, though. Despite he jumps back into the vat situation, he comes back for her. It's usurious and toxic. And I'm worried about what it says in terms of culture in 2016.
Well, moving on, we have Rick Flagg, who of course has, you know, two strong, single syllable strong sounding words for his name, because he's that kind of guy. Rick Flagg, played by Joel Kinnaman, formerly the RoboCop.
Yeah, this guy does not have screen appeal. I found myself every time he was on screen saying, all right, it's strained hero guy. Because again, we're in the DC universe as currently constructed, where anyone who is cast as a hero doesn't want to be a hero, not reluctantly. You never want to be any of these people. you want to be the bad people, particularly in this film, because they never suffer any retribution. The thing that got me early in this movie with their first and a half introduction, because we get Deadshot and we get Harley Quinn before the title card, and then we get a secondary introduction to them as well as everybody else, and we get this weird music video, quick but too quick to read, baseball card ization of who they are. And when they gave us Rick Flagg, the last thing was something about being good at golf. And Matt, there was a GD golf ball hitting a cup noise when that graphic appeared on screen.
Well, that whole portion of the movie early on is a result of Warner Brothers being shocked that people, maybe not being shocked, let me dial back my venom just a bit. Warner Brothers saw how Deadpool was doing and said, hey, we can make that in our movie, right? Well, not without reshoots. And oh, wait a minute, people like these negative people, i.e. Deadpool and this Suicide Squad. Let's move their introductions up early with reshoots, with Viola Davis having a scene, as I have in my notes. Let's see, where I believe it's called Amanda Waller's Expositional Introductional Dinner. So there's a reason that there's all that zip. And as I was sitting there going, hey, this has kind of some zip to it. This is fun. Like, there must have been a bunch of curmudgeons who didn't like this movie, because I'm having fun in the first 15 to 20 minutes. That's because they were making it like Deadpool.
Well, I think that scene is not one that was reshot. I think the way they came to restructure it, and you know, we've talked about it, state it for, you know, the record for those that don't know, there are two cuts of this movie. There's the one that Ayer assembled, and there's the one that, with his cooperation, the same company that cut the trailer that gathered so much buzz about this movie, Trailer Park, did a cut of this movie, and then they were stitched together like some kind of DC Universe villain.
And by the way, the David Ayer's editor, who is the credited editor, delivered Ayer's cut and then left the project. So I don't know who was doing the physical editing, and I don't know that for a credit discussion or things like that it particularly matters, but that's the degree. I mean, certainly, you know, Warner Brothers says, you know, well, we all had some different ideas and we all came to an understanding. Okay, that's true enough. Let's just not forget, though, that your original editor didn't see the movie all the way through. And I don't mean, you know, watch the footage. I mean, your final editor isn't the one that delivered the footage or the version that we saw in theaters, which, you know, can be a little troubling, unless, of course, you're paying for the darn thing, as Warner Brothers did, and then I guess you get what you want. Speaking of get what you want, Pete, Amanda Waller, who I think could probably tell us how to get away with murder. Get it? Because it's Viola Davis.
How to get away with murderverse.
I have no complaints about Amanda Waller. Tough, professional, easy enough to understand. I mean, it's not kind of this convoluted, you know, what are their motivations? Although, frankly, none of these characters have convoluted motivations. I thought, as the person who ostensibly is in charge of the whole thing, and maybe in terms of number of lines or that kind of thing, probably is second billing to Will Smith, I have no complaints. Great character, great actress.
I really dug what she did in the role. She, you know, this is a woman through The Help and other movies in the past couple of years, has really come on the scene and established herself on TV with How to Get Away with Murder, making herself a bona fide film star here. She'll be back in their other movies. The thing that I wanted to say to you in the theater that I held off, that I'll say now, is, okay, we get the exposition. The next Superman might not share our values. several times, actually. And I'm saying, why are we assembling this team for what threat? Oh, for a hypothetical threat. And then the threat winds up being one of them.
So you're saying that maybe as presented, her management rationale to the U.S. government was not a good one?
I guess what I'm saying is, write me a better setup. Write me a better premise. You want to bring a dirty dozen together, have a better... I mean, can we agree that it's a lousy threat?
It certainly is, in that the bad guy, you know, in this super long list of people on the team and people connected to the team, and people who arrested people who ended up on the team, to have your bad guy come from one of the team, to me, does strike me as narratively easy. I won't quite say lazy, because I think David Ayer has gotten, he's gotten too much nonsense over this movie's imperfections. But it does strike me as, if this had more time in the oven, you would come up with a better villain than the most powerful person on the team, who must be controlled physically and not controlled through some sort of, you know, like, you know, do this and we'll just see your daughter, or you know, we'll let you out of jail. Like somebody who's all but physically imprisoned into the team in some sort of, you know, weird physical, spiritual way. That's the source of your bad guy.
And maybe the most compelling story of all of them, this tortured love that they throw at you, albeit very quick. But I kind of felt for June Moon and for Flag, given that setup. But, oh, they couldn't contain it, and it goes that way. Which, all right, plus points for the unpredictability, but at the same time, just nowhere near as strong. And to have the big reveal, or the seemingly big reveal, that HVT1, that high value target one, is not some, you know, Murderverse alum. It's not going to be Batman or somebody else we got to rescue. It's their boss. It's the woman who assembled them. It falls short. And then they've got to rescue her again.
I thought that that was a neat twist. Now I could step back from the movie and say, wait a minute, that's just another inward-facing writerly thing where you now don't need to introduce anything new. It's just, surprise, it's somebody who you knew all along. So I guess what I'm trying to say is this. I can unappreciate it after the fact, but as I was watching the movie and he goes to the door and it's like, wait a minute, he's in the thing with her. I'll give him a thumbs up for that. Anyhow, next on the list is Captain Boomerang, played by Jai Courtney. Just want to point out Jai Courtney, of course, an alum of Spartacus Blood and Sand, which was the very first thing I ever podcasted, and no copies of it exist on the internet anymore.
And I'm going to say, Captain Australian cliche, please.
Well, we'll talk about cliches in a little while, but... I thought for what he was, which is, you know, there's clearly this line where he's not a Deadshot, Joker, Harley, Rick Flag, or Amanda Waller. He now starts the and the rest of the team bunch. I thought the actor did a great job. I thought the character was kind of delightfully 2.5 dimensional, and that you weren't like really like, oh, I need to find out what motivates him. He's just a crazy guy who robs banks and likes pink unicorns. If that's your cute little character affectation, it worked for me. I chuckled, and I liked Captain Boomerang.
I didn't really get enough of the character past the forced humor to really develop any affinity. Okay, he's an Aussie. He likes unicorns. He throws a boomerang drone later in the movie, and in his second scene, he's ostensibly unable to be understood. There was somebody about 5 or 6 rows ahead of us who was hard of hearing, who had the digital subtitles, and I actually went to that to try to understand what he was saying at one point.
Wow. Well, next on the list, and certainly somebody who we're going to talk about later on in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, we have El Diablo, played by Jay Hernandez, a character who, in the greatest of comic tropes, is so incredibly powerful, but there's a thing, in this case his own regret, that prevents him from using his powers until it is, you know, advantageous to the story. Again, a comic book movie problem and a comic book thing that existed way before the script of this movie.
And that's what makes this such a mixed bag for me, is there's things that you like about these characters, but then the overall execution just winds up falling flat or short. And I dug what they were doing with the reluctant villain. Is he even a villain? Did he even do these things? We have the video. No, that's not me, man. All this other stuff. And then later on, we get the big reveals, and you're like, really? Really?
Yeah. There's something not working completely great with this character. Certainly, you're sympathetic to his situation, all of that. But part of how the other characters treat him is what turned me off, and I'll save that for a little bit later. Pete, next up, Killer Croc, as played by Adewale Akinoye Agbaje. Pete, your thoughts on Killer Croc?
This actor has now played, as a character actor, he's carved out some decent niches in two comic universes. He played in Thor the Dark World. He played, I think it's Curse.
Ah, yes, the kind of the secondary bad guy,
yes,
to the Christopher Eccleston bad guy.
Yeah, and here is Killer Croc, you know, somebody who's got a following in the DC universe. They managed to turn him into a really forced and, again, given our time, inappropriate stereotype.
Yeah, and we'll discuss that stereotype in a little bit. Here are some positive words for Killer Croc. Really dug the makeup. There were a couple times where I'm like, oh, he's wearing that hoodie, so they only needed to put him in the front part of the makeup and not all the way around or whatever. But even then, there were scenes where he's in the hoodie where the hood comes down. I'm like, oh, rats, they outsmarted me. Visually, I thought that the character was really, really compelling.
Yeah, but, you know, hey, we're going to throw a side of beef into the sewer where we're keeping him. Okay, everybody's got to eat, but then why are there now guards in there? Like, what needs to happen that they're in there doing that? Oh, I know. In the script, it says, and we show him beat up guards because he's bad.
Next up, we have Cara Delevingne playing Enchantress and Dr. June Moon, kind of the baddie and also the crux of the whole thing, Pete.
I really cared for this character given the story, which is amazing how they, you know, streamlined it. Doug, you know, particularly when she's in the one scene with the military types where she says the name and the hand kind of come, the black hand comes from underneath and then flips her over, was an interesting presentation. But, you know, later on in the movie, she's got these wavy things coming off of her and it's just so over the top with the CGI. It erodes.
There certainly is a point in the last third of the movie where Enchantress somehow has gone from speaking whatever her native tongue was to, like, all of a sudden it's like, I shall now speak loud bad guy. You dare come to me without the heart and I shall destroy. And it's like, they're not asking for a lot of nuance here.
There's a 3-minute stretch during the climactic battle when Diablo and her golem-like brother are, you know, fighting, that she doesn't do anything but make magic in the sky.
Pete, that should be the name of our next podcast. The Make Magic in the Sky podcast. Next on the list.
Am I right? Like, jump in there. Help him out.
Look, there are major problems with the third act, particularly its it goes on too long for me. For all the editing, I think that they didn't tighten this movie up enough. And it's not in the fault. It's not. I don't find fault of editing and pace in the first third, where things are zipping along and it's the fun, as you said, Pete, baseball card kind of introduction. It's not the fault of the slower second act, which every second act needs to slow down as we go, guys, wait a minute. The problem. Oh no, it's getting worse. You know, that's every story. It's the third act where you gotta sell me on it, and that's where the pace kind of slowed down. Next on the list, Pete, amongst all these baddies, a mostly goodie, Katana, played by Karen Fukuhara.
This movie is so overstuffed that, you know, you throw another character here. What seems, at least from backstory, as a quality character, but it's, okay, she's Asian. Her husband was killed. The souls of her victims are trapped in her sword. You don't understand her because she speaks Japanese. That's it. And, you know, she and Slipknot are you know, packed in there the last minute. And I'm saying to myself, okay, but it's so busy, Matt. It's just so busy.
Well, and you mentioned Slipknot. Here we have actor Adam Beach, a Canadian First Nations person. So we have this diversity, and he's introduced as one of the people on the team even before he's in the team. Like, it's one of these graphics, maybe when they're setting up the neck exploder things, or, you know, kind of mugshot style. And then he's in the thing for two scenes, and you realize, oh, they introduced a minority character so that he could be the example of, like, look, these neck grenade de facto collar things really do work, and now he's dead.
And I had, like, a problem with that. Told you when it happened. Let's introduce a Native American character who's clearly playing somebody with that type of heritage. And again, bad guys team up. Good guys can't get along in this universe, but bad guys team up with the drop of a hat, and boom, we just killed them.
To me, that was one of the more shocking moves. Not that, oh, you killed a minor guy to demonstrate the power of the thing that's not going to keep everybody in line, except for later when Harley gets it turned on. Like, fine, you have to show how the thing works. It's Chekhov's gun. You have to explain what the gun is. In this case, the neck bomb thing. But, like, why did you go out of your way? I felt like the movie was trying to say, look, we're so inclusive, you know, in addition to actors of color in, you know, Will Smith and Viola Davis and Adewale. We're also, you know, we're getting all kinds of diversity here. But, you know, this one guy is the first one to be cannon fodder, or even worse, story cannon fodder. Did not make sense to me. Next, Pete, almost left him off the list, but Griggs, played by Ike Barinholtz, that's kind of your head guard guy. There was a charm to him, even though at one point the script kind of let him down.
Yeah, you know, we get him early on, and he's taunting Deadshot. He clearly has, as many of the men do, an attraction to Harley Quinn. And then there's this dark side to him. He gets into gambling debts. And then in the middle of a military presence, as they are wheeling her away in a security wheelchair, he's able to hand the Joker's cell phone to Harley Quinn and talk openly of it. Whatever you want to say about performance is taken away by poor writing of character. That was just dumb.
And it's like an iPhone 5. I mean, I get that the Joker is crazy, but come on. Next on the list, GQ Edwards, played by Scott Eastwood. He of the Hollywood Republican Eastwoods. Pete, what kind of impression did GQ Edwards make on you?
That I can't even tell you without looking up who he played. One of the other SEAL guy, maybe?
Yeah, I'm assuming that he, and here's why I make mention of it.
I know what the Edwards, I'm sorry, what Scott Eastwood looks like, but like there was, I think, a baseball cap involved and maybe some facial hair or yeah.
Yeah, I only mention it. I mean, clearly it's not a large role. I'm going to assume that it's you know, Navy SEAL helper number one. Maybe it's also Edwards who, you know, is the one that detonates the bomb, killing himself and saving the rest of the team. It's just like, you go get Clint Eastwood's son here. You think, you know, who has a recognizable Clint Eastwood face by virtue of DNA, et cetera. To me, I didn't know I was watching Clint Eastwood's son the entire time. And then Pete, last but not least, we have a guy who used to sleep in the apartment over Kevin Smith's comic book shop. None other than Ben Affleck returning as both Batman and Bruce Wayne in a dual role. Your thoughts on Der Fledermaus?
The thing that took me even more out of this at the end, he's sitting with Amanda Waller in the secret scene, the mid-credit scene, getting the roster of metahumans, because that's their thing. And you see Aquaman in there, you see the other ones he's looking for. She's just dealt with a bunch of them. And he places her under his protection as Bruce Wayne, or does she know that he's Batman? Much has been made in the press, the state of Ben Affleck right now. He was seen leaving the Suicide Squad premiere with his shirt untucked and then retucked into his belt. He's a mess. And this character is a mess because, as anyone who's already seen the Justice League footage put out during San Diego Comic-Con, which was screened for media during a set visit about a month to 6 weeks ago, now he's jokey Batman. Now he's, oh, hey, Flash, I'm gonna throw a batarang at you and make laughs. Yeah.
Well, I'll just mention Pete, just because we don't we share all the comics book news. It's also worth mentioning that after this past Wednesday night, there was a Suicide Squad party, after party in London, and this might be to what you are referring, but Pete, he made a mistake that I think all we gentlemen are guilty of from time to time. I just don't have $1,000 suits. He had his fly down, Pete, and his shirt was sticking out there, just the shirt. Got to do the quick check before you step out into media.
Listen, everybody is entitled to their life away from their work, and this guy is an artist with extreme visibility. But given the problems that this rapidly assembled film universe has suffered, retconned onto the first seeming standalone movie with Man of Steel, which wasn't supposed to be part of this larger universe, that maybe they could be like, all right, hey, let's slow down. This guy's got some stuff and some things going outside in the real world with the on again, off again relationship with Jennifer Garner and everything else. The guy's a basket case right now. Maybe that's what they want. Maybe that would make a more believable Bruce Wayne. I just feel sorry for the guy.
Well, last but not least, in this cast list here, we have Ezra Miller as not Grant Gustin's The Flash. I read that there was going to be this surprise cameo thing. I guess that's what it was. I got no problem with Ezra Miller as The Flash, other than the fact that, from what I've seen of The Flash TV show, Grant Gustin is one of the most charming people I've ever seen on TV. But that's not Ezra Miller's problem. And I thought it was cool that The Flash caught Captain Boomerang and added to the breadth of this universe.
Because Batman can't catch them all. And until you renamed who he caught, I couldn't remember.
Ah, well, there you go. With that, Pete, let's move on to the good, the bad, and the ugly. Let's talk about some of the good. I thought that the casting, as we've just discussed it, I thought the casting was pretty spot on.
well, you've got two black leads in positions of power. The likable Will Smith, and here made to not be trusted, Amanda Waller. But I think, again, given this assembly of talent, that the results should have been greater than this sloppy hole.
Wow, it's the tough words there. I also thought that some of these DC extras that we have mentioned, Batman showing up, the Flash cameo, kind of the ongoing story of Superman being dead, some scenes in Arkham Asylum. I felt that none of that was kind of, none of that was over the top. None of that was like, oh, do you remember in Batman and Robin when he's like, this is why Superman works alone? Like, none of it was kind of with that kind of shock and awe. It was just like, yeah, this is the world we live in where there's Batman and the Flash and Superman's dead and Arkham Asylum. I thought it worked.
What takes me again out of it is, we got the geography in the last movie. Here's Metropolis, Gotham's across the bay. Now we have, what was it, Midpoint City or Mid City or whatever the hell it was. It's Chicago. It's where Chicago is on, the continent of the United States, and these made up cities. But then we still have New Orleans and this bayou, hole. And then we throw away the whole facility that they're in.
Which was a good line, by the way.
It was a good line. And again, there's things I like in this movie, but the overall, just, not one of these two movies that's come out. I've seen Man of Steel more than once. Batman v Superman or this one, do I want to watch again?
Ooh. Midway City, indeed. And as you said,
looking a lot like Midpoint, man. Midpoint, Midway, whatever.
Also, as mentioned before, I thought that the job that they did transposing Harley from the world of cartoons into this, real world, rounded, insane character whose boundaries and motivations still make sense despite her insanity. I thought that was a really, really nice job in the transition. Also, like that they had the briefest of scenes there where Harley's in the classic suit and her and Joker are dancing. That, Pete, based on an Alex Ross drawing, the composition of which was based on art that his mother drew. So, I mean, this is going deep. This is like Alex Ross and then Alex Ross's art and then Alex Ross's mom all in that one little moment of Joker and Harley dancing.
The motley, the pleather motley getup. I mean, you have to do it. Should it have been a bigger part? I guess it's hard to put her in that suit in real world situations. But, to come back to her two-dimensionality that you mentioned, bringing her from the animated series to here, and we're talking about a character now with a 20 plus year history and a soft spot in a lot of people's hearts. The abuse angle is really what worries me, that, once she's duped so that she'll free the Joker, then he electrocutes her. And then the next time, sequentially, chronologically, that we see her, she's got no ill effects of the electrocution. I'm just going to hurt you real bad. And now you're going to jump into the vat to prove you love me. I'm really worried about the message that sends here with a female character, with a bad female character that a lot of people love.
Well, I think there's a little question that the character, the Joker here, vicious and frightening. The entire scene when he's talking with goon guy who has all sorts of facial piercings, I was convinced they were going to go for the low-hanging fruit of, to show you that the Joker is bad, he's going to pull this guy's nose ring out. The fact that that was the bomb waiting to go off and they didn't explode the bomb, that's what Hitchcock says to do. That's what tension is. And again, despite this list of Heath Ledger, Mark Hamill, Jack Nicholson, and Cesar Romero, Jared Leto, for all his weirdness on set, you know, Will Smith never met Jared Leto because Jared Leto was in character all the time and had to be called Mr. J. And apparently he sent like dead pigs by mail to everybody in the cast. That's all really messed up and I think over the top. But I kind of don't care. Put it on the screen. He put it on the screen, and this was a new, dark, scary version of the Joker.
I'm so tired of the frat boy narrative of, hey, do you know that the Joker killed Heath Ledger? Yeah, I read he went into a hotel in Paris, and he was there for a month getting the laugh down and going crazy, and then that's what killed him. And that Leto steps into this role, an accomplished artist in his own right, coming off an Oscar, not getting the Oscar as a result of this, and it's, I gotta adapt crazy behavior to become the character. I gotta go full method on you. I'm so tired of it. Can we get somebody that, hey, you know, I'm going to play the Joker and I'm going to play him crazy instead of needing to get myself into that place by sending dead animals to members of the cast.
Well, with that, Pete, on that note, let's move into the bad here. To me, the list starts with, as mentioned before, Amanda Waller's expositional introductional dinner. You said it was not necessarily a product of reshoots, but certainly the fact that you're choosing to have a cast so big that you need to do an interesting storytelling thing that doesn't fit the tone of the rest of the movie to introduce them quickly. Yeah, but you're the one that said there needed to be all these characters, now you need to come up with ways to introduce them that in and of itself was perfectly fine. It's just that's not the movie that you get to 2 hours later.
I kept asking myself, I think I even asked you during this scene, why are there men with machine guns around them in a restaurant that's clearly closed off for them? Like, what is the threat? Show me the threat. Oh, the threat's one of the people they already have.
Yeah. there's that. There's also the night fights. So many night fights.
Rain.
They only fight at night.
And in rain, Matt, we joke all the time with the Supergirl show that Cat Grant does glasses acting, which is to say, well, Matt, you say what it is to say.
Right. She will have glasses on her face at the start of the scene because in the middle of the scene, that's when she needs to take them off and use them to point at Kara. And then, or Kara, and then oftentimes in the same scene, when she's done talking, you know, it's like, you know, she's dropped the mic on whatever because she's the boss. It's then the glasses go back on because that's the acting cue that she's done. And it's like, okay, same thing here. We have, it's going to rain because now things are really serious and awful and difficult.
Well, guess what? Rain is the Cat Grant glasses acting of the DC Murderverse, when we're supposed to have emotion and action and everything all at the same time. Hey, start up the rain machine.
I also want to mention that these kind of, you know, as the soldiers or whatever get turned into zombie bad guys, there's this neat effect. They have the CG black eye heads and with all the eyes on and whatnot. Part of the reason that they do the night fight, I think, is because they then switch from CG black eye head zombie bad guys to guys wearing rubber masks with bumps on them for stunt doubles. So you don't need to see it. So you don't need to spend the money on it. And it's like, are we really using the time of day to hide the expensive, interesting bad guy that you decided we needed to have? It just could have been, I am working for Enchantress, and now you put black makeup around my eyes, or now you make my skin gray with gray makeup. No, you need to save money by not lighting them because it's night, because they're expensive, because you decided to make them expensive.
In fairness, you get the reveal for our Suicide Squad. These are people. That guy had an expensive watch on. We then see others brought before her and turned into this. But you know, I was taken out by the need to CG that up.
Also want to mention, there were jokes in this. There were more than the, oh no, there's only five jokes and they're all in the trailer that everybody loves. We need to do reshoots for more jokes. Maybe that's where more of the jokes came from. I don't know. But there was not a lot of laughter in our theater. I mean, I chuckled at some lines. Other people, you know, you'd hear one or two people chuckling at things that they found funny. But I don't know. I was promised more ha-ha than this.
And I think there were people ready to ha-ha, Matt. You know, I would have liked to have seen it in that sold out show that we couldn't make, just to see the response, because there wasn't much of a response where we saw it.
Yeah. And of course, we've talked about the pacing. So many characters need attention, that particularly that final act feels bloated. We have to have Deadshot getting the daughter moment, and Flag gets the girlfriend moment, and the girl comes back, and the Joker is dead, but the Joker's not dead, and Diablo finds peace. Oh, and so does Katana.
Yeah, there's just so much going on. That fight is interminable. Then we've got to throw in false realities. But wait, Diablo, here's my secret. I'm somehow connected to you, and I don't get that. It's just, there's so much, and it's a danger of these ensembles. Yet it can be avoided. Don't include so many.
Well, now let's talk here about the ugly. Let's start with gender. I think Harley is independent enough, but then you have that scene, unquestionably, where Joker makes the decision to drive the car into the river. He can swim. She can't. He's ready to drown her to escape. There's not a gender argument around that. He's willing to sacrifice her for him. And as you said, Pete, that's part of this message, or the questionable message.
She keeps going back to him. The electrocution, that. I get it that you want to have this crazy love between them, but given how little we see, and you know the Joker, and you apparently know Harley Quinn, and you're supposed to just know that they're crazy, and whatever we throw you, you're going to buy. It doesn't work that way, okay? I want to know what elderly gentleman who came in with a walker took away from that.
Well, Pete, also on the topic of gender, and I'll choose my words carefully here, I appreciate the female form as much as the next guy, but there's one scene, you know, I was going to say one scene early on, but of course Katana joins the film, you know, about a third of the way through, and more on that in a little bit, but her costume in the bosom area was so tight that particular body part was like being squished in two. There was like a top part and a bottom part.
It's that strange, like, tape thing. Like, you are taped up at the top and around. Cultural, I guess. Not practical.
I just don't know why. I mean, again, you want to make all these people look good, and it happens to be, as it is time and time again, you know, the women are going to be on more display than the men. You know, I don't want to say fine, but okay, that at least that's a known quantity. Do we have to be strapping her down so much that you're squishing things? Anyhow, Pete, continuing the ugly, let's talk about race. Let's talk about Katana. She walks on that chopper at the last moment. Look, Pete, it's an Asian person. Slipknot walks on for one more moment. Look, he's dead.
Yeah, it's worrisome. The overall message, and I think it's lost in the convoluted storytelling, and then all the controversy given the criticism of this movie, and the critics are out to get it, and you know, everything like that. Let's look at message.
And then we move to Diablo, who SA gets every hombre nickname, burrito, churro, barrio. So many stereotypes this side of Jaime Escalante's calculus class. That was over the top. You want to have a little bit of a suggestion of like a racial thing where you're throwing some Spanish his way to kind of highlight that he's different from whoever is speaking. It was too much. It was over the top. It was too much where you're like, am I supposed to think Will Smith is like maybe not Will Smith. I mean, am I supposed to think that Deadshot is actually racist, or is he just saying stuff to get this guy going? Okay, I guess he got him going, so it's okay to, like, hombre him to death, I guess?
In so many ways, this was filmmaking in reverse. Oh, let's have a date, but not have a script. Let's have characters, but not have characterization. And here it's, you know, we want to have the reveal, but let's not build up anything really behind it. And it would have been better, show us less. This could have used much less. We didn't need to see the wife. We didn't need to see the children. Just talk about it. Just talk about it. In the same way, thinking like, really, Batman's going to hold up on you because when he goes to arrest you, you've got the daughter. Like, what version of Batman does that ever square with?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the version in which the biggest star in the movie gets the choicest scenes, perhaps. Last on the list, at least for kind of concerns about race here, Killer Croc as a metaphor for blackness. He's been told that he's ugly. He's been told he's a thug. So he becomes that. And then what does he want? He just wants to live in the sewer. You know, he's not out to improve himself. What's his big goal in life? To get BET in jail. Deadshot wants visitation rights. Insane Harley Quinn wants high-end Italian coffee. Croc wants booty-shaking rap videos.
I could not believe this when this happened. I get the presentation, and I get even the, you know, they tried to Deadpool this up. All right, we're going to make it, oh, he likes to watch rap videos and that kind of stuff. You know, he calls a guy bruh at one point. Okay. But man, if it doesn't come across really poorly.
Yeah. I was shocked as somebody who's concerned about how we can represent ourselves as society and all different facets of society, how that can be represented in culture. I don't know how this got caught. Now, you want to say, well, they worried less about the introduction of an Asian character late in the first act, because at least she was being introduced and she had as many interesting facets in terms of her backstory, a dead husband, just the same as other people's dead family members. Fine. This was just kind of borderline horrific stereotype and shockingly so.
They're going to study this as what not to do.
Well, Pete, and last but not least, in the ugly portion here, we've been talking about the pacing. It's got this zippy start, slower middle, very slow end. We have to service every character and the resolution of their daughter, girlfriend, BET desires, etc. I think that Warner Brothers must have known that there was a pacing start. I'm convinced that the Joker's rescue was meant to be a mid-credit scene and the Batfleck return meant to be a secret scene. I'm convinced that they were both pushed up because they sensed people wouldn't want to sit through all the credits to get all the movie.
It's possible. We've come to expect those kind of conventions in these cinematic universe films now. It's just that, holy moly, man, you get through that battle and then there's the denouement of them getting the things, and we've seen what they want in a vision and everything there. Again, just stuffed to the gills. This is a casserole of confusion, Matt.
Wow. I think, Pete, that's the note upon which to end things. Well, Pete, you know what's not confused is the love that we get from our patrons on patreon.com/fantasticgeek, particularly Mary Kirk. I want to thank everybody on Patreon for helping make the podcast storage and bandwidth costs that are associated with making Fantastic Geek happen. I want to thank all of them for helping make that possible.
You really do help us out. And, you know, there's a variety of perks on there now and some more coming soon that we just want to be able to give you something back for all that you give us.
Pete, of course, the greatest perk is being able to talk to you on Twitter. How can people do so?
You can find me on Twitter at Peter, P-I-E-T-E-R-J, Ketelaar, K-E-T-E-L-A-A-R, 8,139 followers. Can't be wrong.
And while I am personally on Twitter as Looking Back Lost, you can be in touch with the podcast in a whole variety of ways. It's almost enough for each member of Suicide Squad. We are Fantastic Geek. That's Fantastic with the PH. And you can find us under that name on .com, the Gmail, the Instagram, the Twitter. But wait, Pete, there's more.
Facebook.com/Fantastic Geek, all one word, with the PH. Like us. We're better than the Suicide Squad.
All you need is your special someone to send you an old iPhone, and you can like us, you can tweet us, you can be in touch. It's that simple. Well, Pete, we will be back soon talking, whether it's Star Trek, whether it's the latest in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, whether it's outside that, whatever the latest in geeky goings-on there is. So for now, I will say goodbye to one and all and give you the final word.
And.
We'll be right back.